Morning, neighbors. This is Long John with the party line once again. We're around from midnight to 5 o'clock, 5 mornings during the week. Saturday mornings and Sunday mornings, we continue through to 5:30. Monday mornings, we get started about 1. Figure that out, and you'll come up to about 35 hours of conversation. And we talk with a lot of interesting people. This morning, we have Al Lottman with us, insurance broker of J.J. Farber Lottman. Ellery Lanier, author and lecturer, been with the cyberneticist, and Frank Edwards, news commentator. Frank Edwards is with the Mutual Network, and we wanted to talk with him this morning. Frank wrote the book, My First 10 Million Sponsors, and he's been interested in flying saucers for a number of years, the occult, psychic phenomena, all the offbeat things. And recently I was talking with Lyle Stewart, the publisher, and we were talking about Frank Edwards, and he said, John, he said, you know, I have a book coming out in a couple of weeks that Frank wrote. And the title of it is Stranger Than Science. This will be out in about a week. And I've got a couple of advanced copies, and Frank is in town today, so we invited him to join us. We're going to be talking about the book. The title of it is Stranger Than Science. The publisher, Lyle Stewart, the author, my guest in the morning, Frank Edwards. Frank, usually I think about 25 or 30 of the minutes of the top of the show. Morning, we go round robin around the table. But the gentleman seated at my left, Al Lottman, about a week or 10 days ago, when I told him we were going to have Frank Edwards on, he was very, very excited about this. He said, you mean Frank Edwards, the news commentator? I said, that's right. He said, John, can I get on the show? He said, this is a man that I've admired for years. And I said, yes, sir. I'll book you. He said, look, I'm going to read up about the man. I said, I guess we're going to be talking about how a man handles a news show and all like that. I said, no, we're going to be discussing psychic phenomena. We'll be talking about flying saucers. Oh, he said, then, no, this is not the Edwards that I mean. I thought you were going to have the fellow on the great commentator. I said, look, this is the man that you're thinking of, Frank Edwards. Now, I said, Frank Edwards writes for Fate magazine. Oh, he said, please, that's not the Edwards. In other words, what I'm trying to tell you, Frank, is that this man, Al Lottman, was extremely interested in meeting you. He listened to you for years, but when he heard that you possibly believe in some of the flying saucer stories and some of these stories about the mediums and the spiritualists and all like that, something happened. In other words, the man figured it can't be the same man. Now, I was wondering, would you like to comment on that, Frank?
Well, yes, I think this is an understandable attitude on his part, because he probably confused me with another Edwards, who is on another network, Doug Edwards, a very fine commentator. And a lot of people do that. There's Doug Edwards, and then there's me, Doug Up Edwards. Well, I think Al's confusion is understandable.
Well, Al, I'm going to give you a few minutes to start off. This is the Frank Edwards, the man that you've admired for years. And why you feel that there must, that evidently Frank Edwards has gone soft or something because he believes in flying saucers is amazing. I believe in some of the things, certainly not all of them. And just because you sit around here many nights and you figure that anybody that comes on the show and talks about an experience in astral projection or an experience of seeing a saucer or something like that, automatically you label them all kooks. And I presume that actually you're labeling Frank Edwards as a kook too.
Always putting me in this box. I haven't said a word. He and I are...
You've been indicted.
Indicted, and I can see the thoughts that are going through Frank's mind. Thanks, John. But I am not confused with the network. And Frank Edwards was a news commentator sponsored by the AF of L and CIO, or individually, one of the two.
Just the AF of L.
Yes. Right. Frank Edwards gave what I would classify as Phil Dew, an interpretive analysis of the news, which was brilliant. And I mean that, Frank, and I'm not trying to make up to you right at the beginning. I really felt that way. He represented a viewpoint that I thought was a right viewpoint. That was subjective. It was different than any other news commentating on the air. It was objective, and yet it was subjective from a human viewpoint. Now, there was my elation and excitement. I cannot reconcile, Frank, a man whose interpretive powers in terms of news are as great as yours with something that is so unreal for me, something that represents, in most cases, such utter nonsense. I just don't reconcile the two things, Frank.
Well, what you're really asking me, I'm sure, is you're really putting the question to me, why do I persist in regarding these so-called sources as realities? Well, I do this, Al, because during the 12 years or so that I have been interested in these things, I've had reason to change my mind about them. At first, I thought they were some development of ours, and I'm sure there were a lot of other people in these countries who thought that. But as the years went by and things happened, I realized, as did many other people, that these things, or most of them, are nothing more than conventional objects seen under unusual circumstances and misconstrued by people who do not recognize them for what they are. But there is a small percentage of these things that simply cannot be explained away as conventional objects. And the Air Force certainly doesn't regard them as conventional objects because it has upon occasion issued orders to shoot them down. You don't shoot down hallucinations, and you don't shoot down atmospheric disturbances, you don't shoot down temperature inversions. These things have to be real and solid. Now, I belong to an organization called NICAP. Do you know about it, Al?
Yes.
Now, this is headed by Admiral Hillencutter, who was for a long time the head of Central Intelligence. Hillencutter was in a position to know what was going on. We also have
referring to Clinton.
The Clinton was the director. The chairman of the board is Admiral Hillencutter.
I've never heard this name before.
Really?
As far as NICAP is concerned.
Oh, yes. See, our first one was Admiral Farney, the father of our guided missile and the man who coined the term guided missile.
That I know.
And he liked the rest of us on the board, and he said so publicly in his opening statement. I was convinced that things came from somewhere in space and that they were entering our atmosphere and had been for quite a while and that they were the work of intelligent beings and were certainly not subject to human control. And Admiral Farney said this, not exactly in those words, but that's as nearly as I can remember. That was the gist of it. So now the chairman of the board is Admiral Hillencutter, the former head of Central Intelligence. We also have on the board Colonel Farney, who headed one of the Air Force saucer research projects. I certainly was in a position to know what was known as far as our official research program is concerned. So many things have happened in this field that if you are close to it and have been able to get at some of the facts in it around the carefully laid censorship plans and the plan of deception and confusion that has been has existed and bad reporting too, if you want to know that, one sees that there is something substantial there, although we may not know what it is or where it comes from, and we certainly do not control it. But for that reason, I don't know what the things are, and I've never seen one. But I have many friends who are very competent people and certainly credible. I know a lot of people who are not, I'm not friends of mine, but I know them, and I regard their opinion very highly. One of them is Dr. James Bartlett, the head of the astronomy division at the University of Maryland, who has seen the things and so had a real good look at them, and people of his standing and airline pilots and so forth, they're certainly seeing something, and it's something over which we have no control. For want of a better name, we've called them flying saucers. Well, I agree with the Air Force that flying saucers do not exist, but unidentified flying objects do exist. And I don't know what they are, as I say, but that's why I've been interested, because in my opinion, as a newsman, this gets back to what you said to me, in my opinion as a newsman, and in my judgment as a newsman of 36 years experience in broadcasting alone, I feel that this could be one of the biggest news stories of all time if we can get the facts out before the public and the reality of these things and their origin, as some of us suspect the origin to be, can be confirmed.
Well, Frank, I think it's for a moment, I think we should find out the point things about the origin of the conference.
Oh, yes, I agree with Dr. Herman Oberth and with Admiral Farney and others that these things are probably interplanetary and that I have no idea where they come from, but I am confident in view of all the evidence that has piled up about them that they certainly do not originate on the Earth, but where they come from and why, I don't know.
sight and things there and lies my objection. I'm just an unidentified flying object. Oh, I can understand that, and I do have an interest also. I don't believe in an ostrich hiding its head in the sand. Something occurs, therefore the interest is valid, and it's necessary. What I'm objecting to is this, and where I'm presented an enigma to me, Frank, is this. I'm here 36 years of feminine, and I underline that word, your background. I'm always aghast at your acceptance and your alliance, I may phrase it that way, as those who deal in the occult and mystical. Science, Frank, is the eventual answer to most of the truths of life. Here, it has not certainly explained everything. Here we have unidentified flying objects. Fine. Let me say, with some of the evidence presented, you are led to believe that that things represent some form of human intelligence from outside the planet.
Well, not human, but
some. All right. Or some form of intelligence, anyway.
Yes.
Human or otherwise. I have several questions which are all tied up. One, what evidence from any credible source? Two, please explain at the same time, Frank, some of the associations of those who join that I characterize in the coach, and I do, I definitely do, those who believe in forms of mysticism and occultism which have nothing and shouldn't have anything to do with research into what constitutes an unexplained flying object. The associations trouble me.
Would you do us a large favor, Mr. Loudman? I know that you're anxious to get closer to our guests, but you're constantly crowding into the microphone. It makes it rather difficult for our engineer.
Sorry, Mr. King.
Continue, please.
I'm glad you brought science into this because this puts it in a frame of reference where I think I might be able to shed a little light on my own attitude toward the matter. All things have been photographed, and they have been seen. And they have been tracked by radar, and the government has issued a book on how to recognize them when you see them on a radar screen, how they performed when they came over the city of Washington in numbers on the night of July 19th and 20th, 1952, and about three nights later they were back again, and then on the night of August 13th, 1952, according to this government book, which I have in my possession, there were 68 of them over Washington at one time, and the book was issued for the guidance of control tower men and other men, how to recognize the things and how to know what you were seeing when you saw them. Now, to those who haven't seen them, let me say that these things are fully as real as cosmic rays. I've never seen one of them either, but I have seen the tracks that they've made when they were photographed. I've also seen the pictures of these things when they have been photographed. And so they are at least as real as cosmic rays, and for that reason, they constitute another thing that we know exists, but which we certainly do not fully understand. People sometimes ask me, why do you believe in flying saucers? Well, that's a rather broad question. What do they mean by believe in them? I think that it's like this. I feel this way about it. I feel that this is like the two ghosts who were sitting on the cemetery wall one night watching the airplanes go over, and one ghost said to the other, say, do you believe in people? And probably the ghosts hadn't been playing around themselves, but there was reason to believe that maybe something was up there. I'm not being smart-alecky about this, Al. I'm not trying to sell anybody on flying saucers. I don't care whether anybody believes that such things exist or not. I believe it. The government believes it. The Air Force believes it. And a lot of scientists believe it. So if a lot of people don't want to believe it, it's all right with me. As I said a while ago, I'm interested in it because I think. But if my suspicions, and I have nothing more than suspicions, I don't know where they come from, but if my suspicions are true, then the story of these unidentified flying objects certainly constitutes a major news story.
Well, they would constitute a major news story if there were some evidence to back up your suspicions. Now, I cannot...
What do you consider evidence?
Oh, I can tell you what I consider evidence, Frank, and I've stated this several times. I want a credible source. And by a credible source, I will accept any scientific body who are objective. And I'm sorry to say this, but it's not necessarily applies to you. And this does not include newsmen, because often they engage in some form of ritual dramatics. That is part of their occupational pursuit. Now, I'm not angry at them, but it is so. I want a credible scientific source, a university, somebody, Well, to be accepted as an objective person and a person with a background in knowledge to tell me there is science, some form of scientific evidence, and here we will give it to you, that from an interplanetary source, a craft has been sighted over the Earth.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought that up because I'll be able to answer your question. On about 7 o'clock on the morning of June the 30th, 1908, there was a great ball of fire that came in over the Yenisei River in Siberia. The thing exploded. It was a tremendous blast. It was so great that it was recorded all around the world. They realized that it was some great explosion, some tremendous shock, but that it could not have been an earthquake because it possessed none of the characteristics of an earthquake, and the universities and the various laboratories and observatories that recorded this realized that it was a shock, and they were able to locate it reasonably well, but they were not able to identify it. Well, in 1908, there was very little understanding of atomic reactions, as you well know. And so it was because of World War I and the great disruption that took place in Russia, it was 1927 before a scientific party got to the scene of the so-called Tunguska meteorite. They all assumed, for want of anything else to assume, that this was a great meteorite that had struck there. They discovered a very strange thing about it. But for many miles around the scene of this blast, the trees were all swept down flat. They were brushed down against the ground. They were charred on the side facing the center of the blast. In my book, if I may be permitted to stick in a commercial here, in my book, Stranger Than Science, there is an article on this covering it in considerable detail. And the blast was a very tremendous explosion of some sort. Now, if it had been a meteorite, there would have been some sort of meteoritic crater there. But there was no crater. There was only this great mass of charred forest spreading for miles away from the center of the blast. This puzzled the scientists who went there. But they had nothing, they had no yardstick by which to figure what this thing could have been. When we exploded our atomic bomb at Hiroshima, actually the Russians were interested in it, so they sent a party over there, and a member of the party was Dr. Alexander Kazintsev. He was also a member of the various scientific expeditions which had been to the scene of the Tunguska meteorite, as it was known, and still listed that way in the records. While he was at Hiroshima, he noticed a peculiarity. That right under the so-called cone of the blast, directly under the point where the bomb had exploded, the tops of the trees were snapped off and they hung down, and the limbs on the trees were stripped and hanging down, just stripped down the trunk. Well, this was a very odd-looking thing, and out away from the center of the blast, the trees were flattened out and brushed to earth and charred on the side toward the blast itself. Suddenly it dawned on him that the only other place that he'd ever seen a thing like this was at the Tunguska meteorite. So he and his colleagues began comparing notes, and they went back and they got the Soviet government to organize another expedition. Actually, they organized two. They went up there with radiation gear, and they discovered that they could trace out a cone of radiation directly in the center of the blast, just as they had at Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And it had all the radiation characteristics of this. They also found some bits of alloyed metal around the edge of the cone of the blast. And then when they went back and examined the eyewitness reports, they found that there was the typical mushroom cloud, and that the people who went into this area had died of a strange malady. They went back and they were able to exhume many of them, and they all showed signs of excessive radioactivity in the bones. So obviously there had been some sort of a powerful radioactive performance there. And after after three Russian expeditions had been up there, I will find on the front page of the New York Times for October the 4th a story there, which is the third one that has been published on this, that this was an atomic-powered spaceship that weighed many thousands of tons, that for some reason it was trying to make an emergency landing when it blew up at an altitude of 1 2/10 miles, and brought out what is known in the books as a Tunguska meteorite, but actually it was a spaceship, an atomic-powered one at that.
Ben? Edward, I read the news story in the Times, but they were quoting Russian scientists.
Yeah.
This was at the Times.
explosion. I'm quoting Russian scientists.
Yes, that's right.
But one of the possible explanations that actually had two. One was that it might have been a spaceship. The other one that it might have been some a radioactive explosion of unknown origin from outside the Earth.
Well, let me pursue that.
Also, there was something very interesting in the article, too, which I quoted another Russian scientist about his theory that the two moons of Mars are really artificial satellites put up into orbit thousands of years ago by people who had lived on Mars and had tried to escape.
Valerie sent me a note a moment ago, and I think he said the Times reported it, saying that the Russians said it may have been a spaceship.
Yes. Well, it did, Sam, and his group reported to the Russian Academy of Science that all the evidence was conclusive that it was a spaceship and that they found these alloyed metals.
The report in the Times said that the implication was that they were assuming that it was a spaceship. They didn't state it as a fact.
Well, let me explain what happened on this thing. This was a different expedition, and the ones who are quoted in the Times are the fellows who denied when Kazintsev and his group reported that it was a spaceship. Academy of Science meeting over there, and these fellows denied that that it was, but when they went over there and made their own investigation...
Yeah, this was a very recent...
Yeah, they changed their tune completely. They say, well, maybe it was. This is quite a change on their part.
There's also supposed to be...
You'll find that Kazintsev is not mentioned in that Times article.
There's also supposed to be a certain amount of residual radioactivity in the area
that proceeds by...
What would have been ground zero at a nuclear blast?
Directly into the blast.
Don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to compete or combat any scientific information, because I surely think...
Well, you said
none.
That you would like to know that someone had...
I have to rely. Right. Now, you've offered something, but I use the word something because that's all it means to me. They are a group of Russian scientists, and their accomplishments, incidentally, are something one cannot evade or avoid. They're indeed accomplished. However, it's still, it seems to me, a theory expounded by some Russian scientists, which has some validity, and one must look up, but nothing more at the moment than a theory. Now, speaking as a layperson and one who is interested in the news events of the day, I have one more question to pursue from a scientific viewpoint. Here is a subject of unbelievable, importance, isn't even the proper word, I can't think of one. The impact is enormous. I can think of nothing in my lifetime. But if it were so, if it were true, nothing in my lifetime of greater importance or drama than the possibility of life on other planets and advanced life, or some form of intelligence anyway, sending craft to this Earth. Nothing, it seems to me, including the wars which we've lived through, have reached greater importance. All right. Now, following that, in your agreement with me, I now ask you one more question. Are there any scientists of repute, or any scientists of repute, who today, to your knowledge, have taken this matter seriously and are engaging in valid, again I use the word credible, research?
Well, let me answer you in two sections. One, do you consider Dr. Herman Oberth as a scientist of repute? I mean, I've got to have your answer so that I'll know what you mean.
The reason I smiled was never referring to Dr. Oberth. It was the embarrassment at my own ignorance.
Dr. Herman Oberth is the father of modern rocket science. He's a Romanian. He's lived in Germany for many years. He was the man who organized rocket research in Germany. He was the man who organized the great rocket team to build Hitler's rockets for him. And has written many books on space travel, and I'd say that next to Tsiolkovsky, the Russian, that he is probably one of the two outstanding men. The Russian's dead now, isn't he? He died, I think, about 20 years ago. But Oberth has just gone back to Germany after 5 years at Redstone Arsenal down here. Oberth headed a German government's research in this, which was actually a cooperative effort between the Scandinavian countries and Holland and Belgium and West Germany, looking into these looking into these so-called flying saucer UFOs. In 1954, when he concluded this program for him, then he held a press conference at which he said that his opinion of himself and his colleagues, and then his opinion of himself and his colleagues, that these objects were interplanetary in origin, that they probably did not originate in our galaxy, and that they were operated by intelligent beings of a very high order, and were probably propelled by distorting the gravitational field. He just repeated that in February of 1958 when he went back to Germany.
And
I don't think it would be unfair to say that the opinion of, say, the scientific community about Dr. Hans Oberth is much the same as what was the opinion held about Nikolai Tesla. Professor was a man of undoubted genius who, in the later years of his life, entertained some strange ideas.
Well, of course, anyone who flies in the face of conventions entertaining strange ideas, and that was true of Einstein. It was also true of...
My wording was supposed to be polite.
I had known that you were going to ask this question, because I could have brought with me a letter, which I cannot use publicly, but which I mentioned in one of my books. I showed it to Willie Lay one night on a program called Author Meets the Critic, a TV show. And we were, Kinkle and I were on there with one of Major Kinkle's books. And the critic was Willie Lay, who was certainly a very eminent man in his field. And we were to be on a 20-station TV network. And without any warning whatever, we were cut down to one station that night. And maybe it was just happenstance, but that's beside the point. What happened was that I was able to show Mr. Lay in the middle of the program a letter signed by a group of eminent government physicists who are engaged in work for the United States government, and they said in this letter that after evaluating the evidence and materials submitted to them over a period of years, they were convinced that these objects were operated by intelligent beings of a very high order and were not terrestrial in origin. And I have the letters.
Let me interrupt here for a moment to take care of some business, and then we'll be back with our guests in a few minutes.
Question, Frank, was not answered.
Oh, no. Can you wait just a moment? I want to introduce a guest, and then I'll give you a chance again, Al. Also, I think at this time, we should remind our listeners that tomorrow night, or rather tonight, I'm sorry, we're into Sunday already. Tonight, at 8:15 p.m. at the Philosophical Research Center, and that's located at 211 West 57th Street in New York. I'll repeat that in a moment if you want to get a pencil and paper to make a note of it. Ellery Lanier will deliver a lecture on the subject of the untold secrets of the flying saucers. It's ideal for a holiday gift to get some of these and send them to the...
And outside of the question of flying saucers from other planets, I was very pleased to find that in your new book, Stranger Than Science, you have a record of a man who almost... Let me see, this is 1959, and that was somewhere about 1880s or so, and John Keeley, who had built a machine, a device, which achieved physical levitation long before, that was quite some time before the turn of the 20th century. Could you tell us something about John Keeley?
John Worrell Keeley was a very unusual fellow. He was a musician and a magician, and he was an inventor. And he seemed to be a very conscientious man, and the National Cyclopedia of his day gave him a very fine biographical sketch in there. And if John Keeley was a crook, no one was ever able to prove it, and certainly some of the best scientists of his time tried to expose him, and he gave some of them his cooperation with the consent of the stockholders, but at least one of them who was sent by the stockholders to examine Keeley's invention said that he did not fully understand it, but he had seen enough to convince him that Keeley's invention was everything that he said it was. What Keeley did was to build a machine, and he called it by a long technical, compound technical name, which didn't mean much to me and possibly didn't mean much to him, because I have a feeling that perhaps Keeley didn't understand what he had either. But this machine was one that had tremendous power. And he demonstrated it many times to stockholders and to various other groups. And it drove this, for one thing, it drove a lead ball through an oak plank, a foot thick, which nothing else in his time could do. It bent steel rails as though they were putty. And there was not another machine that existed in that day that could do that. And it performed various feats, but it never got to the point under his control or development where he felt like it could be safely be put out on the market or put to practical use, although the demonstrations were always very impressive. After Kelly Keeley died, they found a huge tank of compressed air. They found a huge tank of compressed air in the basement of his home, but there was nothing nothing new about that, really, except to the reporters, because Keeley had shown the stockholders and several hundred people the tank of air, and it was connected with the machine only by some relatively thin and weak brass pipes, so it couldn't have carried very much pressure. Certainly couldn't have caused the machine to do what the machine obviously did time after time in the presence of many witnesses.
Well, you have a thin outlet to a huge tank of compressed air. You can build up tremendous pressure on that limited area.
Well, I'm quoting the men who investigated for the irate stockholders after Keeley's death, and they said that it was not possible for him to have used the air in this cylinder at enough pressure to have made the machine perform as it did.
Well, maybe Keeley was in advance of the knowledge of hydraulics at his time. I don't think
there were no hydraulics involved.
Well, with compressed air, I think.
Oh, I agree.
But what did he explain that his machines were anti-gravity?
No. According to the explanation that I found in my research on Keeley, he hinted that this was some sort of an atomic disintegration process.
Yeah.
And, but he called it by a vacuo pressure. Ellery, do you know what the name for it was? I forgot it.
Well, I'll confess that I had done a good deal of research into Keeley's work, but this was quite some years ago, and I haven't had contact with the work. There was one volume of records of Keeley's work that I was supposed to get, and there was a very, very fascinating woman by the name of Natasha Randova, who went into it at an old bookshop in New York City some time ago. And that book had a good deal of the mathematical analysis of the Keeley motor. And Mr. Keeley was not quite as illiterate or ignorant as his attackers claim he was. And in effect, what he was doing was using sympathetic vibrations focused to the center of a sphere to achieve certain effects. And being a musician and having done a good deal of experiments in with vibrations, he apparently hit on something that we're just beginning to hit again. And the proof of it, of course, was that he did accomplish these very strange results in his laboratories, which tanks of compressed air in the basement could never accomplish, no matter how efficiently they were built. And as I recall now, too, I examined one of Keeley's machines, which is in the city of Philadelphia, and it is a marvelous example. It's in a glass case, so I don't know. It's a marvelous example of the toolmaker's art in any case. And I do recall, too, that he had this tremendously heavy machinery in his laboratories, which would occasionally be found in another part of the room, and there was no physical means of transporting that weight around. And, of course, no one really knows how Keeley got this stuff shifted around from one part of the building to the other.
Well, it was a very fascinating story. I spent quite a bit of time in research on it. It's been several years ago. And I distinctly remember that he didn't seem to be able to describe the operations of the machine in terms of the scientific knowledge of his time, because he seemed to be far ahead of his time, but he did the best he could with this long-winded name for it. But he did say that it was some sort of what he called an atomic disintegration process.
Yes, yes.
And he said he thought it needed a great deal more study and research before it could be safely put to use.
I remember one other thing that Keeley did, which sounds very amusing. It sounds almost ridiculous. But if you realize that with the present business of atomic powers operating because a couple of little particles start a spark that keeps sparking more and more sparks through the whole mess of stuff. The thing isn't quite as strange as it sounds, but Keeley used to pick up his violin and just play one note on the violin, and this great big metallic sphere would suddenly start to spin, and it would go on spinning for days, just as a result of this one sound that he produced on his violin.
I was wondering, Frank, you've given us some ideas about Keeley. I was wondering if you had any opinions about Otis T. Carr. Does that name ring a bell with you, sir?
Well, I remember that when I was on the program here before, John, 20 years or so ago, I got a telegram from Mr. Otis Carr, who was then, I believe, in Baltimore.
Yes,
I think. And wanted me to come up there and see an anti-gravity machine that he said he had built. Mm-hmm. I couldn't go, and I really don't know anything about him other than that, other than a few little stories that I've seen about him on the news wires from time to time. Personally, I don't know anything about it, except that I do know that he's made these claims from time to time, mm-hmm. and that there have been some skeptics who felt that perhaps he was overstating his case.
Mm-hmm. We went out to Oklahoma City for the launching, and naturally they didn't even take it out of the warehouse. They, for some reason, there was a mercury leak or something, they claimed later. And that was just about the end of it, at least temporarily anyway, but we haven't...
Does he have some sort of a machine?
Oh, it's a beautiful thing.
How big is it?
6 foot. 6 foot prototype model. I'm not talking about the anti-gravitational machine. No, I'm talking about the OTC circular foil craft. The prototype model of the craft that he had hoped to be able to go to the moon.
Did you ever see it fly? Or do you know anyone who did?
No. And that's why we went out. Eight of us went out to Oklahoma City on, we were there for April 19th. That was the day it was to be launched. It's a beautiful contraption, and it looks great. I'm not a scientist, and I'm not mechanically inclined, so I couldn't tell you whether there's a possibility that it could go up or not. I do know this, because this may have been window dressing, but it seems that they had a little difficulty with the, what is the department that has to do with aviation? Not FCC.
CAB.
CAB, is that it?
Mm-hmm.
The office.
Yeah.
Well, two of them. One is the administrative and the other is the executive.
Well, one of the offices in Oklahoma City, one of the officials of the department that would handle these things made them purchase a winch and 400 feet of nylon cord before they could launch this so it wouldn't get out of control, because I gather from this that the government thought that there's a possibility that this would go up higher, they would lose control over it, and it may cause an accident in some other part of the country.
Well, John, that's a conventional fish. Oh, that's a customary move in these cases.
You see the 400 feet in
the yes. I mean, and you saw it too, man. It was outside the room. Ben, I'll even show you. You're standing next to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll show you the photograph, yeah. Now, if you ask me whether Foreman put a line on it, I would venture to say there was. I mean, but I'm not in a position. I didn't actually measure. But there was a winch there, and this was a big piece, a big hunk of iron.
So maybe the winch should have been above it.
They have those.
Yeah, well, you know, the government asking him to buy this winch is, you know, I imagine if Otis T. Carr announced that he was going to go through with his plans on December 7th to fly to the moon, I imagine also the government would ask him to file a flight plan, but that doesn't mean they seriously expect him to do it. They just expect him to go through with the regulations and the rigmarole that are attendant upon all these things.
With Frank here, we don't want to spend a lot of time
Speaking of statement here about this thing that I just mentioned about the flight plan to the moon, I had a briefing down in Washington the other day about a top scientist who devotes a lot of time to studying Russian scientific developments, and he's works closely with Scandinavian and other intelligence units over there. He points out that at the time the Russians hit the moon, the guidance problem was relatively simple. To hit the moon, you're much simpler than, as you know, actually orbiting the thing or grazing it and making pictures or transmitting them by television at exactly the right thing in the right time and back. And he said, since the Russians did not have this fantastically good
equipment at the time they hit the moon, obviously. And this means that they would have had to have built this, all this wonderfully intricate and responsive gear, between the time they hit the moon and the time they sent an outfit around it that photographed it, developed the film, and sent back the pictures by television. And this has led many scientists to suspect, so this man told me, that the Russians actually sacrificed a man in this thing in order to have some responsive method in the thing of developing the film, aiming the thing, and sending back the pictures at exactly the time they wanted. I know that they have tried on three occasions to send men into space, just up and back. And we know that they got them back twice. What happened to the third one, we don't know.
Well, now, I had a phone call.
How do we know? Intelligence report?
Yeah. I had a phone call during the past week, during the daytime. I was in my office there. When somebody called me up, they gave me their name. To be very honest with you, I didn't even make a notation of the name, but the name didn't mean a thing to me. I was not impressed. Maybe the man was somebody well-known in his particular profession. I must admit this, that the man sounded like a very intelligent man, and I don't think he was trying to kid or joke around. I think that he really believed it. He told me that he had information. He didn't want to be on the show or anything. But the Russians have 12 people on the moon and have had for over a period of 3 months.
Now, this I don't know. This I question, but I know this to be true from other sources, that they have about 300 people training as astronauts, and the 27 of them are women. And their schedule calls for sending two men and two women to the moon. They do not expect to get the first quartet back.
In other words, they're going to send them to stay there.
Yes, they
hope that they land them there safely.
They will be volunteers who will not expect to get back. Well, it's not beyond the bounds of reason to feel that some patriotic Russian, a member of this same group of astronauts, may have been willing to sacrifice himself for this great scientific glory, which they unquestionably got by beating us to the punch on this phone picture.
Why is we at the moment? We're talking about the Russians.
Why we? I mean the entire civilized world.
I can give you the thinking of our scientists. But this is true of most of the moon, but at the top or bottom of the moon, where the rays strike it at a different angle, the temperature extreme will not be as great, but will be as it is at the poles of the Earth, for example. Of course, it wouldn't be that cold, but it would not be boiling hot either. And we estimate that by our people digging in or finding themselves a cover of some sort, that they could survive there for quite a while. Of course, they'd have to take their oxygen with them and their water. And
I'd just like to say, I don't know who you spoke to at Washington and what intelligence reports he had access to, but that's quite true that it's easier to hit the moon than it is to orbit around it. But this is like saying it's easier to build an atom bomb than an H-bomb. It's still a monumental task. And as far as sacrificing a man so that he could have someone to develop film and take pictures or something, that sounds to me to be somewhat wishful thinking on the part of the man who said it, because actually, in a condition such as being in orbit around the moon, automatic instruments to take pictures and transmit them back to the Earth would be a far higher competence than any man who was sitting in a space vehicle orbiting around the moon, because the man would be practically worthless, whereas the instruments wouldn't be bothered at all. So the idea of putting a man into orbit is something of an achievement in itself, but the idea of doing it because the equipment isn't good enough, this sounds rather far-fetched.
If you didn't have the equipment to do it, but you had the man who could do it, and you were in a rush to get it done, what would you do?
Well, if you have equipment that is capable of monitoring a flight, and you can do it and put it in orbit around the moon, you have the auxiliary equipment that would process, which would take a picture of the far side of the moon and to transmit it back to the Earth. This kind of equipment is
not... Did they have any, though, that would put one into orbit around the moon?
Why not?
They haven't done it before.
Well, there are two views about Russian scientists and science, which is practically hysterical. It's prevalent in this country. One is that they're a bunch of ignorant engineers who achieve their performances through sheer luck, and they make 10,000 failures, and they only let us know about the success. That's a completely idiotic view. The other view is that they are supermen who just sit around and they come out with these fantastic achievements and we're 10,000 years behind them. This is also a ridiculous view. They happen to be just as good and as bad as we are.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that's the thinking of these scientists to whom this man referred. And I think that because they felt that the Russians were only mortal and that they didn't have this gear a short time ago, they probably did not have it at the time that they made the pictures in the room.
Actually, over 70 chapters in this book. And the price of it is $4.95. It's published by Lyle Stewart. It has a black paper jacket on it with sort of a chartreuse green printing. And it's a fantastic book, and I know that you'll want to own a copy. And Frank is kind enough to join us this morning to give us some of his opinions about things and also to tell us about some of the stories. Al Lottman.
Frank, I have to come back to the original opening with John. I still have no plausible explanation for you. I don't. Well, background again, I say this sincerely, it's most impressive to me. I told you, I listen sincerely, I've been a fan of yours for years. Your news reporting to me represents rationality, deep interpretive powers, etc. Now, coming back again to your work of these days, the flying sources, which we batted around for a bit. I started to say a little earlier, and I'd ask you a question. The alliance, Frank, that I see among many who are in the flying saucer field, shall I say, the believers, their alliance with the occultists, Ben, I am not calling names at the moment. I would to some others who might appear in this program, and I've done it before, but not to Frank, because I respect
them. Characterizing the believers,
yeah, I'm asking a question. Again, the occult and the mystic. But Frank, really and truly, there are many things alike that are not to be explained. But science in themselves have often found explanations for what some people thought was a mystical or occult force. Science has explained many of them. Would you please explain to me the alliance between those who have what I think might be a valid scientific survey of unidentified flying objects, but then their alliance with those who believe in mysticism and occultism, which in 99 out of 100 cases, is again just sheer unmitigated nonsense.
Well, Al, I can't explain what you call the alliance between these people because I'm not a part of it and I don't know anything about it. I am interested, as I said to you a while ago, in the subject of these unidentified flying objects, and I'm calling them by the same name that the United States government calls them. They've spent tremendous amounts of money investigating them. The government thinks that they're real.
No, please excuse me. I don't mean to be rude, but now I'm asking a different question. Your interest, and this goes to your book, which makes wonderful reading. Again, I read it and enjoyed it. If you offered it as just interest. But everything you're doing in here seems to imply, look, here are amazing things. Here are things that happen. Here is proof of mystical and occult forces. Now I'm questioning you on this, Frank. Where in your belief in this?
Well, I am simply reporting. I'm not explaining because I can't explain. Science can't explain the things that are in that book. Science has not been able to explain them. That's why they're all open-end articles. There's no explanation for them in the light of conventional science. There are a great many things that science does not know. We know that we've only had organized science for about 75 years. But science has made tremendous strides in that period of time. But actually, we know that we've hardly scratched the surface. And the things that are being brought out every few months, each year, and the thing that I have done in this book is to print in there, to report in there, documented instances for which we have no explanation, but for which we have proof that they happened.
May we discuss the first one, which is The Mystery of David Lane?
Yes, sir. I'll be glad to go as far as I can, which is as far as science can go.
All right. David Lane disappeared, just to put it in a capsule.
Yeah.
This occurred on September 23rd, 1880. David Lane disappeared literally in a matter of seconds in the full view of some members of his family and some friends, I think, totaling approximately 5 feet.
That was a judge,
right,
and the judge's brother, who was an attorney there at the time.
Thank you. Questions.
Yes.
One, what is the documentary evidence of this particular incident?
I got the documentary evidence on this from the county records at Gallatin, Tennessee, from the records in the state house in Tennessee. They sent quite a few men down there to probe this ground to see if he could have gone into some hole. And also from the statements made by this judge and by his brother and by the family of the man who disappeared. And now this man's case was never solved because there was no solution to it. He is still listed as missing.
Frank, I believe that the man disappeared, of course.
Yes.
I'm not inferring, I may have worded it badly, that by any chance you're fabricating in your book. Of course not. You are relating stories as a news reporter that you have checked that they allegedly happened. But I'm going a little deeper than that. I believe that somebody told the story that David Lane, that there was a David Lane, that somebody told the story that he disappeared in the view of five people. No question about that. I'm not imputing anything as to your reporting of it. But the question I'm asking, what documentary evidence exists, if any, that these people didn't do a little dreaming and tell a story? Has there been any evidence at all that this literally happened?
If there was, the state of Tennessee couldn't find it at the time it happened, or, you know, in the subsequent years.
Now, in your news reporting and your career, have you not come across stories, Frank, of where people relate almost incredible events? Then, upon investigation, it is found that the relation of these events either occurred somewhere in the deep recesses of their mind, some form of mental aberration, or a little more practical purpose, where to cover up some true story, they made up some fantastic story.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Now, it is, now I'm going to conjecture a possibly a silly hypothesis, but the story of David Lane, my own mind is trying to seek an explanation. An unscientific mind, but an unbeliever in anything. You know the explanation I came up with? Mr. David Lane got tired of a shrew wife. He disappeared. Her pride was hurt, terribly hurt. She was left with two children, and in collusion with a couple of friends, made up a fantastic story. Go disprove it. Now, there's documentary evidence that she went to, for example, if it happened today, that she went to the police department of the city of New York and said, my husband and my full view disappeared. Do something. Therefore, you are entitled to report that story, Frank. But in the wildest stretch of anybody's imagination, that doesn't necessarily mean it's the truth.
It's something that Ed Spingarn brought up on the program once, which I think is very apropos to this. He said that he would make two statements. He says one of which would be extremely easy to disprove, and the second one would be impossible to disprove. And his first statement was that he is a qualified programmer of computing machines. Obviously, you could ask him two or three questions, you'd find out he wasn't. This is the statement he says very easy to disprove. The second statement he said that's impossible to disprove is that he arrived at the studio tonight by a flying saucer which landed on the roof of the building he lives in and let him out over 1440 Broadway, and he came down here. Now, disprove that statement. Now, the David Lane statement, I submit, belongs into that latter category of something reported that could never be disproved.
Frank, aren't there about 10 or 20,000 cases like the Lane case on record?
There are many cases of disappearance, of course, which for which there is no answer. What?
There are several cases are reported in the books. I think
The reason I used the David Lane case was because it was the subject of an intensive and prolonged official probe. They did everything possible to find out what happened to this man. and there was no indication whatever that there was any unpleasant connotations involved in the story, or that there, nor was there any indication that any of these witnesses had deviated from the truth.
Here's another point, however. Now, the very last paragraph in relating the story tells of the incident that a stranger's disappearance itself was the experience that happened to Lang's two youngsters approximately 7 months after it vanished. If I may, just the ending of this story from David Lang. The children noticed that at the spot they had last been seen, there was a circle of stunted yellow grass and 15 feet in diameter. On that evening, as they stood beside the circle, 11-year-old Sarah called to their father, and to their astonishment, the youngest youngsters heard his voice calling faintly for help over and over until it faded away forever. Frank, question one. An 11-year-old child, have an imagination. Life? Understandable. Today, children come into our home with stories sometimes, but you just look at them where their imagination, where they can get such vivid imaginations. Two, where is this documented that a child told somebody?
The mother gave the state of Tennessee a sworn statement on that, and she heard the same thing the evening before.
That's did an alienist ever examine Mrs. Wang?
I don't know that there were
any
alienists in those
days. That's the point I'm trying to make.
I think that this is a great tragedy of... Many times when children make statements that sound wild or fantastic and they are laughed at and ignored, and this is a very tragic thing, because children have seen many things that seemed absolutely impossible.
Sometimes like listening to you.
Your comment was not a comment upon what I was saying. Your comment was a personal comment and unnecessary.
If you
relight your pipe so that you get the smoke coming properly, you might be able to listen to what I'm saying instead of going off into a personal tangent.
I'll try.
And if you heard what I said, I don't know if you
heard. Well, I heard what you said.
Well, would you comment on what I said, not on the condition of my mind, which you can't know anything about?
What you said, Ellery, or what I thought you said, was that it's a shame that we ignore some of the stories of our children, because we might find a lot of truth in these stories. I saw a ghost. I don't want to go to sleep. There was a ghost in the room last night. Don't ignore this child. Maybe there was a ghost, Ellery. Is that the point?
That's not the point of my statement.
The law book is full of cases
of the
statement in court because of children's testimony.
The point of my statement is quite something else again. The point of my statement is that there have been many observations made by children or adults, which didn't happen to jibe with the notions of the other individuals surrounding them. And that this just a simple attitude of dismissing a thing, well, a child said this, a child reported this, this is a very vicious thing and a very destructive thing. And I say that in essence, the idea of having a lack of respect for a child is in itself a very degrading thing to the person who has that lack of respect.
Oh, Ellery, please.
Why is it waiting to have a
lack of respect? I have an affection for children. I love them. There is no question whatsoever. But please, don't dramatize and come up with just a silly exposition that it is malicious, that it is terrible, and one lacks respect for a child. When a child comes in with a childish story, and you are not hurting the child, you are not being distrustful, you're not being cruel, when you don't accept an imaginative story of a child, Ellery. Please, you're over-dramatizing.
I'm not over-dramatizing anything, and it's the old saw about the peasants who would report to the lord of the manor that a rock fell out of the sky and the rock was made of metal, and they were laughed at because they were ignorant peasants. This has been told over and over and over again, and here the same thing happens with children. Children see things that are
ridiculous. There is such a lot of fallacy in what you say. because some children may have reported certain stories which adults disbelieved and later was checked to find out that it was true. This does not mean that we should give credence to everything that children say. And this exaggerated love and respect for children is something I don't... They're incomplete human beings. I mean, why you...
Speak for yourself.
I'm not a child here. You're the one who's speaking for
me. I would ask Frank, outside of the Frank, the Lang story, Frank... I have a story in your book about a woman whose image appeared as a photographic image on the window of a building.
These things have happened quite a few times.
Could you give us a rundown on that story?
I think I have several of them in the book. I happen to know about one of them very well because it happened in New Albany, Indiana, which is my old hometown down on the river, Ohio River, right across from Louisville. This lady's name was Sharp. And hundreds and hundreds of people saw this thing. Shortly after she died, her picture appeared in the glass or on the window of her home, and it was there until sometime after her son arrived, a considerable time after her funeral, actually. And when the son got there, of course, he was puzzled by this, like a lot of others. And he rubbed his handkerchief over the thing, and the picture faded out. Whether it faded out instantly or not, I don't know. But, I mean, after he did this, within a very short time afterward, the picture had faded and was gone. But there are quite a few cases of this type. In fact, there was one right down in Washington, D.C., which I mentioned in the book, where a picture of a man and an elderly lady...